This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. The HIV outbreak in Scott County 5 years ago prompted Indiana lawmakers to allow for the creation of syringe exchange programs. The service provides clean needles to IV drug users in an effort to stop the spread of infections. Last week, state lawmakers approved a bill that extends these programs to the summer of 2022. And today, we're talking about the idea behind them and what we've learned in the last 5 years since they were created in Indiana. And if you have questions or comments on our show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. Most of our show is pre-recorded, so we can't take your voicemails, but we would love if you would join us on the conversation on our social media. Right now, we're talking with Justin Phillips, executive director and founder of Overdose Lifeline. Justin, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you get involved in efforts around this?
Syringe service programs are an element of harm reduction. And harm reduction, it really is the most effective approach to the opioid public health crisis. So Overdose Lifeline, we deal more directly with harm reduction in the sense of distribution of the overdose reversal drug, but it's all part of getting people into recovery, honestly.
What is Overdose Lifeline, if you could sum it up?
Sure. We're a nonprofit based here in Indianapolis, serving the state, trying to fill the gaps in knowledge and change the language around substance use disorder and mitigating the effects of the opioid crisis.
State lawmakers allowed syringe exchange programs to be created in 2015. After the HIV outbreak in Scott County in southern Indiana. Did you support the programs back then?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in 2015, we were sort of working side by side to change the law for access to the overdose reversal drug at the same time that syringe exchange programs were passing in the legislation.
Why are the syringe exchange programs such an important part of the effort against the entire opioid crisis?
Mm-hmm. It's a doorway into having a conversation. Shame and stigma are a huge barrier to recovery. So if I'm an individual suffering with this chronic disease and someone meets me where I am and talks to me in the most simplest sense about, here, let's just have a clean needle. I don't want you to use drugs, but I understand that currently you are. So let's do it in the safest means possible, which is harm reduction, right? And then as you continue to show up at the syringe exchange program to exchange your needles, I get to have other conversations with you, which include things like, are you in need of food? Are you in need of other basic needs? And then eventually we get to have conversation about recovery.
So it seems to me like that kind of has to be approached in a very genteel way with people who are coming in. How do you get people to come in to get the needles in the first place? Because you're talking about asking people who are doing something that's illegal to go to essentially a government-funded place to take part in this program. Is there a challenge to that?
Sure. I think that's why some syringe exchange programs are potentially more successful than others, because they take themselves into the community. So for example, here in Marion County, there's a mobile van that goes into the community, into the zip codes, into the areas where we know people need to be served. And then people can come to the van. It's less intimidating. It's less of, you know, the government-sponsored agency.
Mm-hmm. How do we get the message to them, though, that these things exist in the first place?
Often word of mouth.
Yeah.
And having conversations with community leaders. So Overdose Lifeline has a presence within the community leaders or individuals who need the service. We also have a presence with others who are sort of the boots on the ground, even more so than we are.
9 of these programs have been created since they were first allowed in 2015. Have you seen some of them in person? What do you think how do you think they've been run?
I do think that they're run well. I think it's unfortunate that we only have 9 when we have 92 counties. But I think it takes the right person in the community who has the passion that does it successfully. We, Overdose Lifeline, work closely with the Marion County Syringe Service Program through the Marion County Health Department. We assist them with some education within the community about why harm reduction and syringe exchange programs matter. So we do have that good partnership.
So can you explain to me then I guess I'm not entirely up on the 9 versus 92. So is it one per county?
Yes.
And there are 9 counties being served right now?
Yes.
Where else in the state should we have them? If you were to wave a wand and say, hey, this is where we need them, do we know that?
We know where the higher incidence of hepatitis C transmission and potential for HIV transmission exists. We know where overdose deaths are higher. Sure, that data is available from the State Department of Health. I would say that it wouldn't hurt to have some type of service in every county, because I think we're naive to believe that IV drug use is not occurring and therefore the potential for the transmission of communicable disease is occurring.
Mm. What was the genesis of your total involvement in this? How did you end up in your role with Overdose Lifeline?
So I was working for a great majority of my career in the prevention of unintentional injury and death to children, and done public health advocacy and grassroots advocacy, primarily around traffic safety. In 2013, my 20-year-old son Aaron died of a heroin overdose.
I'm so sorry.
And I did not, despite my knowledge around substance use disorder, despite my education, I did not understand in 2012 when he acknowledged using heroin and asked for help, and subsequently the year later when he died. We just weren't ready in 2012, 2013 to understand opioids and or the relationship between a prescription and heroin, and the potential for overdose death is real. And so it just was natural for me to recognize I need to do something, because if I don't know, what do other people not know? So that's kind of how Overdose Lifeline started.
Let's set aside syringe exchange then for a second. In your journey with this, which is now going on, you're 7 years in now, where do you see a big need to meet this problem? Where have we not gone yet?
I think we still struggle with the American Medical Association designates substance use disorder, the misuse of any substance, alcohol, drugs, tobacco, as a chronic disease of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And we still are not there. We still judge it as a matter of willpower, and if you wanted to, you could just stop on your own. And we don't treat it like a chronic disease the way we treat other chronic diseases. We're doing better, but we have a long way to go.
So public opinion is a big place where we need to make some adjustments then.
Yes.
And how have you found effective ways to do that? Have you?
I think that talking out loud about it, speaking in public about it, acknowledging, yes, in fact, I am a parent of a young person who used heroin, which is a very stigmatizing drug in and of itself, and being willing to take the criticism, because once one person speaks out, other people are willing to say, me too, you know, and then they're not as afraid because they're not as alone.
Lawmakers last week approved a bill that adds a 1-year extension to the syringe exchange programs in Indiana, extending it to summer of 2022. Why don't you think the bill making them permanent made its way through the General Assembly?
Unfortunately, I think in Indiana, we have to take baby steps. We're conservatives, and I'm grateful we got to 2022 and not 2021. Honestly, it gives us a little more grace, and hopefully the next time we don't have to have any deadline. They just need to exist until we don't need them to exist anymore.
What would you say to somebody then who argues that the program was solved and that there's no longer a need for syringe exchanges?
I think that is a naive statement based on the fact that people are still using intravenously. And until we have mitigated opioid misuse and the use of syringes as a mechanism for delivering substances, we haven't mitigated the spread of communicable disease.
Do you think we're going to be having the exact same conversation a year from now when the assembly votes to extend until 2023? Is this just going to be the same thing every year?
I think that's possible. But I will be hopeful that we can change things between now and then.
have we seen improvements in Indiana that we can tie directly to the syringe exchange programs?
I think that the evidence in Scott County of stopping of an increase of the HIV cases is absolutely evidence, yes.
And what about the argument that we've heard that needle exchange programs could inadvertently encourage drug use?
Sure.
Is there any validity to that?
No. There is no validity. The truth is, if I'm misusing substances, I will misuse a substance whether I have a clean needle or not. And you would be amazed at what people use when they don't have access to clean needles. The only thing syringe exchange programs do is stop the spread of the diseases that come from sharing needles. And the side benefit is they open that door for conversations that push people into recovery. There's plenty of research to show harm reduction programs, syringe exchange programs have enabled individuals into recovery.
Just so we can illustrate the level of desperation that some of these people reach, you said you would be surprised what other people use when they don't have a clean needle. What have you seen? What have you heard about?
There are needles that we know of that have completely almost broken and frayed tips, dangerous to use. All kinds of devices that people can manufacture in order to administer the drugs.
You've talked before about the value of community grassroots efforts. What does that look like in Indiana on this issue?
A majority of the counties have a family member or an individual that has been directly impacted that understands the value of these types of programs, that is trying their best within their county to get something off the ground. Unsung heroes, honestly, who often don't have resources and access to financial supports to make things happen.
Are you happy with the General Assembly approving this one-year extension, or is it frustrating to kind of take a partial step like this?
No, it almost didn't happen. So absolutely we're happy because we were going to be in a world of trouble if it didn't get to happen. So we're very grateful to Representative Claire for getting it introduced because it died originally in the Senate.
Well, we will be talking to Representative Claire in the final segment of this show today. Justin Phillips is Executive Director and Founder of Overdose Lifeline. Justin, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for sharing your story, too. Up next, we'll talk with the health officer for Clark County in southern Indiana. He runs the syringe exchange program there, and he says his views on the concept changed dramatically after doing research and seeing it in person. Our show is pre-taped today, so we can't take your questions or comments on the air, but we would still love to hear what you think. Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. We are back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about syringe exchange programs in Indiana. The General Assembly last week approved a one-year extension on the programs, which extends them until July 2022. This segment's pre-recorded, so we can't get your comments on the air today, but you're welcome to carry on the conversation on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. On the phone now, we're joined by Eric Yazel, health officer in Clark County. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So what do you do there as health officer in Clark County?
Sure. I'm actually an emergency room physician, and then I'm the health officer as well. And a lot of people don't know exactly what your public health departments do, but it's more than you think. We do all the immunizations, and we do the syringe exchange while we're talking today, but we also do restaurant and pool inspections and just a huge plethora of things out in the community.
You keep pretty busy then with that.
There's plenty going on. Seems like there's always something.
So let's go back for a moment to 2015 when the HIV outbreak hit Scott County. You're just south of Scott County. What were you doing at that time, and how much of an impact did the outbreak have on you there?
Sure. I wasn't a county health officer at that time, but I was still an emergency room physician here at Clark Memorial Hospital. And we see approximately 15 to 20% of our patients are from Scott County. So we saw firsthand what was going on. And we'd see patients in the emergency room and diagnose, HIV and hepatitis there. So it was just a real scary time because, you know, we didn't have near the information that we do now, nor the understanding about how to go about addressing it either.
And as you were seeing this, had it hit the news yet, or were you sort of at the beginning of it?
The beginning. It really went from 0 to 60. You know, all of a sudden, you started hearing about sporadic cases, and then next thing you know, it blew up, and, you know, the CDC and every major news organization and, you know, everything in between was here. So it really went fast once we realized there was a problem, but there was a little lag time beforehand.
Did that change how you approached a number of cases that came into the emergency room when you knew that this had started to become kind of a trend? Did you know better to look out for it?
You did, yeah. Once you started to know there was an issue, you know, that started becoming higher in your index of suspicion. And, you know, for us, we saw the overdose deaths firsthand. I mean, that first calendar year, I mean, it was, I think, 3 minutes after midnight, you know, in our peak year when I took care of my first overdose fatality. So, yeah, I mean, it changed everything. We realized what we were doing at the time wasn't working, and we had to look at some alternative solutions.
And so I imagine it has changed quite a bit since then, the number of overdoses or, opioid-related cases. Has that held steady? Has it gone down?
Sure. What we did, we put a lot of programs together to try to address it, including the syringe service program. And in the first calendar year after we started the programs, our overdose death rate dropped by 50% and our ER visits dropped by 50%. And our, you know, injection drug use related medical conditions dropped by about 30-35%.
So what we're talking about today, of course, is the syringe exchange program, and it's expected to be extended. The governor is expected to sign it, which would extend it from 2021 to 2022. At the time, though, when we were at the beginning of this, what did you think about the idea of a syringe exchange program?
You know, I was your typical, I had the same concerns, I guess, that a lot of people probably have now that aren't as familiar with the situation. I wondered if we were enabling people. I wondered if that would result in more syringes on the street. As I also am a physician on the local SWAT team, so I have some law enforcement exposure. The legalities of it were a concern. We just, you know, when the idea first came up, it was really a tough thing to wrap your head around. But the first thing you have to understand is people who use IV drugs are going to use those, whether those syringes are available or not. And, you know, we started seeing people in the ER that were injecting 30 to 40 times a day. You know, I'm trying to fish broken needles out of people's arms because they would use them until the needles would literally break off in their arms. And once you understand that simple fact, the rest of the ideas of a syringe exchange start to make sense really fast.
What was it like? You say you're involved in law enforcement, a physician on the SWAT team. What was the talk like in those circles around that time?
As far as with the opiate thing, you know, they were just really overwhelmed as far as, you know, to try to get it off the, you know, their first priority is to try to get it off the streets. And what you would do is, you know, you'd have a successful, you know, bust, and then someone else would take their place. It's kind of like the old cartoon where somebody puts their finger in a dike and three more spots, you know, break open. You just really couldn't make a headway that way. And then when you talk about doing a syringe exchange, you know, from the law enforcement side of things, that kind of goes against everything they were, you know, have done all their career. So it's a really difficult thing for law enforcement to wrap their head around sometimes.
You've testified in support of the syringe exchange program since then. What changed your mind?
Just what I've seen. You know, I've in the last few years, I've lived it firsthand through working in the emergency department. You know, I've held people's hand as I told them their loved ones died of overdoses. I've diagnosed people with HIV and hepatitis. And, you know, when I became health officer, you know, I inherited the oversight of our syringe service program. And so the first thing I did is go down there and just watch it in action. And I was really surprised at what I saw. I think a lot of people picture somebody just walking in with used needles and walking out with clean ones. And it's so much more than that. You know, number one, our staff has a rapport with these patients. They trust them. They do all sorts of education and healthcare. And it's really a population that doesn't normally access the healthcare system. And this is their one point of access. And so not only would they do education and wraparound services, they would get people into treatment and into recovery. We'd have people come through that say, hey, I'm not here to get syringes. I'm just here to tell you that, you know, I'm in successful recovery. And I mean, that's what it's all about. And then you add in the fact that, you know, we do tons of HIV, hepatitis and STD testing there. So, I mean, it's just a huge public health win that it's hard to, if you sit back and objectively look at the data, it's really hard to ignore what a success it's been.
But how long of an evolution was it, in your opinion? It certainly couldn't have been an overnight flipped switch, that kind of a thing. How long did it take for you to come around to the idea?
It took probably for me, it took, I had already, when I took over as health officer, I'd already kind of wrapped my head around it and was in support of it. But personally, it took me a month or two. And then once I really saw it in action, I was like, okay, this is something that we need. And, you know, I think there's still in the community, it's the same thing. I mean, some people have, you know, kind of come to terms with it. Some people are still adamantly against it. So
what do these syringe exchange programs really look like in practice?
You know, what a typical patient will come in, hopefully bring, you know, any used syringes that they have. They'll sit down with one of our counselors and kind of talk about where they're at, and they'll get an assessment for any physical, you know, illnesses or issues. They'll be offered testing, especially if they haven't been tested recently. They'll be given all sorts of healthcare, you know, information and things like that. They'll talk over recovery options. And then, you know, when it's all said and done, they'll get a clean supply of syringes to use. And how many you get kind of depends on your history. If you one that brings back your syringes every single time, you know, then you get more for a longer, you know, time frame. Whereas if you're somebody who doesn't bring them back, then you may have to come back every day or every couple of days until you build some trust and develop some responsibility that way.
So there's real incentive to be more responsible about it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I guess this seems to me like a population that wouldn't normally interact with healthcare, and I would imagine part of that is has to do with maybe their hesitation to interact with healthcare, and so the environment, is it different from a normal healthcare setting in any way to kind of make them more comfortable?
You know, it's there's a lot more privacy and things like that. You know, a lot of the people who use IV drugs, their only prior interaction has been, you know, when they've had an acute overdose. And, you know, they wake up to, you know, five or six people standing over them, you know, everybody's talking at once. It's just not a good environment to get somebody into recovery or do any kind of education or anything like that. We still try, but it's just not an effective thing. When you go there, there's privacy. It's not hurried. You know, you have kind of a one-to-one interaction. It's calm, controlled environment. And it's just so much more effective. And the numbers are behind that. Somebody who's in a syringe service program is five times more likely to go into recovery. And they're also four times more likely to dispose of their syringes in a sterile manner. So, you know, when people make the argument that syringe service programs lead to more needles out in the community, it's exactly the opposite, actually. And I make the argument that, you know, if you stop engaging and educating your IV drug use population, that's the first thing you'll see is more needles out in the community because they haven't been educated or, you know, interacted with a healthcare provider.
Have some of these programs changed since they were created?
Well, at first we only had offered it, you know, a few days a week till we'd see what the utilization was about and see what the success was. So we've added hours. You know, we're a geographically large county, so we've actually begun to go mobile a little bit to make sure we can meet the needs of people with transportation issues. And then we've just continued to add the services available at the actual program. Recently, we've been able to add somebody that's actually physically on site that's a recovery coach. So if you say, you know what, today I'm ready to try to go into recovery, they literally walk in the room and say, okay, let's walk over to this facility and, you know, and they get education and follow up and things like that, which is really cool. And I think it's really going to help our success rate. So, yeah, we just keep kind of adding the services that we provide there.
So this really provides far more than just giving them clean needles.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why, you know, people call it the needle exchange, or we used to call it the syringe exchange. And that's really why we've changed the name to the syringe service program, because, you know, obviously the program is, you know, a syringe exchange, but there's so much more that goes on there. And I think if the general public really understood that, I think you'd get a lot more, you know, uptake as far as people who are in support of it.
What have you learned seeing people use these services? And I'm assuming talking to some of them.
You know, I think the one thing that I see that's interesting is, you know, the opioid epidemic, I think everyone has this picture of somebody who would use a syringe exchange, and that's not really it. We see all walks of life. We see people who are, you know, gainfully employed that pull up in nice cars, and we see homeless people. I mean, it just spans all aspects of society, all ethnicities. You know, it really has hit the whole community. And then, you know, I think that's the one thing that's got me is what we've already talked about, too, is that this is the only access for a lot of these people to the healthcare system. A lot of these people don't have family physicians You know, their only prior medical care has been, you know, sporadic emergency room visits. So we really are kind of their lifeline into getting better in this program.
One common argument against syringe exchange programs, and we've kind of talked about this, but I'm going to try to get at something else. It's that it encourages drug use. People on your side of the issue, and you're now in support of syringe exchange programs, they typically respond by saying that decades of data shows that this does not happen. This does not encourage drug use. What do you think leads people to oppose syringe exchanges? Do you think it's all about this pragmatic argument, the argument that you used to share, or do you think that there's something more going on?
You know, I think one of the things is what we call compassion fatigue. And, you know, from healthcare providers, first responders, from people who've had friends or family members who use IV drugs, you know, a lot of people have been hurt by this, and there's a lot of anger there. You know, you go to a, you know, you take a firefighter, you know, he pictures his career of, you know, going and running out of a building with, you know, saving a baby. And what he's doing is giving somebody Narcan and having them spit in their face, in his face after they wake up. You know, I do think there's a lot of stigma associated with IV drug use, and people have had negative experiences with some of the IV drug use patients. And then the other thing we as a medical community don't do as good a job of is showing the flip side of that, of people who do get better as a result of the treatments that we do. If you have a heart attack and that same firefighter goes and, you know, shocks them with a defibrillator and rushes them into the hospital, and, you know, 2 weeks later they come out to the fire station and giving everybody high fives for saving a life, we're not doing that with the IV drug use community. You know, we're not taking somebody who got Narcan, you know, from a firefighter and then went to the hospital, got in a program, got recovery, got their life back, job, kids, all that stuff. We're not taking them back to the firehouse and saying, you know, you saved my life and gave me my life back. We're just not doing that. And we need to do a better job of that. I really think that would change some community perceptions that some of the things we do make people better.
I've not heard that term before, compassion fatigue, but I have heard stories about users waking up from Narcan and being irate with healthcare providers or whoever applies the Narcan. That's got to be tough on you.
It is. I mean, you know, it's not what anybody pictured when they went into their careers, you know, from police, fire, EMS to healthcare workers. I mean, that's not the career you thought of is, you know, trying to help, doing everything you can to try to help somebody and have them, you know, essentially save their life. And then they wake up and yell at you. But you have to realize that, like, that's not that person. You know, if you get them better, you know, they are going to be a different person and probably going to come back and thank you someday. And not only them, but their children, you know, their spouses, their parents. You know, this is somebody with a family. And I always say that, you know, no matter how difficult that patient is, there are family members all over that love them. And, you know, we need to do everything we can to take care of them and get them pointed in the right direction. I always say the measure of a society is how it takes care of its most vulnerable people. And these are our most vulnerable people at the time. And so, but I do understand, you know, I understand where there's community frustration there. I just think we need to do a better job of showing them the other side of that coin. So.
Do you think that these programs should be enabled permanently, syringe exchange programs?
You know, there are probably going to be people that are angry with me for saying this, but honestly, I don't know that we need an indefinite extension. I just don't think that I don't want to fight this fight every single year, because there's always going to be some public pushback against it. And, you know, for me, if we did not get that extension, I literally would have to spend the next calendar year trying to figure out how to transition all the patients that use our syringe service program out of the program. You know, that would take up my entire next year, calendar year. And so, you know, I would like a nice long extension period. I don't necessarily need indefinite. You know, my goal is to, you know, to keep working in the community until we don't need these kind of programs anymore. But reality is that's not today, and it's not anytime real soon. And so, you know, hopefully that day comes where I can stand up in front of a, you know, Senate commission and say, you know what, we're good. Thank you for your support. And, you know, we can look at other programs, but, you know, we're not ready yet.
How much have you interacted with lawmakers and other state officials about this? Does it feel like they've listened?
You know what? Even the ones who haven't supported it have listened. I've really been impressed with that. I feel like the first bill that kind of died on the House floor or I can't remember if it's House or Senate floor, but that was supposed to clarify some of the aspects of the syringe service program and add that extension that didn't make it out of House. you know, I think that kind of caught us all by surprise and said, hey, look, you know, we don't have something to extend the window on this, so let's get moving. And once we realized that and got the House Bill 1182 up and running, we said, okay, that's going to buy us another year to 2022 and give us time in the next year or two to make some good common sense decisions on how we're going to extend out. And I feel we're blessed, at least in Southern Indiana, with our House and Senate representatives. They've been very, you know, very supportive. They've listened. They've interacted with us. They've taken all the information, and I really feel like put it to good use. So I've had nothing but good experiences down here.
So have you seen lawmakers change their view on this?
Yeah, we have actually. You know, there's been some that are extremely hesitant that actually voted voted in favor of 1182. I think a couple of our local senators have actually went from no on the prior vote to a yes on 1182 last week. So, yeah, I think they've listened. I think they've taken the information, and I think they've made, you know, made decisions that are for the overall good of the people of Southern Indiana because they know it's the right thing to do.
Eric Gazel is the health officer in Clark County in Southern Indiana. Eric, thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate you having me.
Up next, we'll talk to State Representative Ed Clear, the Republican serving District 72 on Indiana's southern border, who pushed for the syringe exchange programs back in 2015. We'll ask him what they've learned in the years since and why an effort to permanently enable them didn't make it through the State House. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now to our discussion on the syringe exchange program in Indiana. We're joined now by State Representative Ed Clear, a Republican who serves the people of District 72 on the state's southern border. Representative Clear, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Matt. It's good to be with you.
And a quick note, this interview was pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions or comments like usual, but we would love to hear what you think. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. So, Representative Clear, this bill to extend syringe exchange programs another year passed through the House with a strong vote. Are you surprised?
I wasn't surprised when it passed the House. Our hurdle was the Senate. And I was glad we were able to get through that.
What was the hurdle in the Senate?
Senator Merritt had a bill, Senate Bill 207, that would have repealed the sunset on syringe exchange. That bill, I was going to sponsor it in the House, and it died on the Senate floor. I believe the vote was 22-27. So after that bill died, it became a very difficult conversation, and we settled on a one-year extension of the sunset, which gives everybody some breathing room and additional time to continue this very important discussion about syringe service programs.
So you settled on one-year extension. It sounds like it might have been a compromise, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Would you have wanted more?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking forward to working with Senator Merritt on his bill, which again would have repealed the sunset. So I'd prefer for there not to be a sunset, but you know, we can work with a year because again, I think it will provide time to continue the conversation, and most important, it will allow the existing programs to continue. We have nine programs in Indiana, nine different counties, and six of those are up for renewal this year. So had we not passed legislation to extend the sunset, six of Indiana's nine programs would have been facing renewal with a very uncertain future, namely the potential expiration of statutory authority for syringe exchange mid-year next year. So now that's pushed out to July 1, 2022, and we'll give everybody some breathing room.
This isn't the first time an extension appeared in a bill this session. A proposal died in a committee early on. Why did that first attempt fail?
So it was unexpected. What I heard from a lot of people, including senators, was that it wasn't, they didn't have enough information. They didn't have enough data. Some of their questions weren't answered. You know, I think it's unfortunate that it died, but I'm glad we were able to get back on track with an extension. And at this point, we're just looking forward. The Holcomb administration has been tremendous on this issue. Governor Holcomb has been outspoken on harm reduction, and including and especially syringe exchange since he first took office. I really appreciate his leadership and his partnership on this. He had our state's health commissioner, Dr. Chris Box, working on this in the hallways of the State House. I give Dr. Box and her team a lot of credit because I don't think we would have been able to get even the 1 year extension without the support of the Holcomb administration and the good work by Dr. Box and her team.
So what I'm hearing then is you're not at all worried about the governor not signing the bill to extend.
Oh, no, I expect he's looking forward to signing this bill. And, you know, again, he's just been a great supporter on this issue, a great leader on this issue, which is so important for Indiana, not just syringe service programs, but harm reduction in general. It's a new orientation. It's a new way of thinking in Indiana. And we've made a lot of progress in the last several years. The HIV outbreak in Scott County in 2015 created an opportunity to have a conversation about harm reduction. It really forced the conversation. So, you know, it came out of a crisis, which is a shame, but I'm glad we were able to have the conversation then. And I'm glad we are able to continue the conversation. And the governor is an important part of that.
So then if enough people are saying that this is proven to work, what are the arguments that people are making that that the program shouldn't be allowed permanently?
Same things we've always heard, that it is facilitating or even encouraging illegal drug use. You know, it goes back to a lot of very basic issues around substance use disorder and the ongoing stigma associated with that, which gets in the way of prevention and gets in the way of positive change. You know, we need to view substance use disorder as an illness and treat it the way we treat other illnesses.
You led the charge to create the syringe exchanges years ago. What made you want to push for this at the start?
Well, for me, it was a natural response. I mean, it was something I'd always been interested in. You know, I guess it's kind of personal for me. I'm 45 years old. I'll be 46 next month. So I graduated from high school in 1992, which means I came of age during the AIDS epidemic. So I've always been interested in HIV issues, and I've always felt strongly that we should do more. I've looked for opportunities both personally and as a legislator to help. And when we received news of the HIV outbreak in February of 2015, to me, it was a no-brainer that we should get to work on syringe exchange. That was not the consensus view at the time, and it remains the toughest fight I've ever been involved in the State House. But I'm glad I had the opportunity to help move Indiana in that direction. Again, I hate it that it came out of a crisis. I wish there'd never been a crisis, but one of the good things that came out of the crisis in Scott County is a new willingness to embrace harm reduction.
So how successful, in your view, have the programs been?
Oh, they've been tremendously successful. You know, there's a report that's produced every year. It's required by the statute, and it details the number of people who've been served, the number of syringes that have been distributed and recovered, the number of referrals that have been made to treatment and other services, including naloxone distribution, which has become a very important part of these programs. And they're working. They have prevented countless cases of transmission of HIV and hepatitis C and other communicable diseases, and they've saved countless lives.
And there has always been some pushback, as we mentioned before. Some of the most common concerns is that they encourage drug use. Do you think that there is any validity to that whatsoever?
No, and you know, it's not a matter of what I think. It's a matter of what the research shows. And the overwhelming research evidence supports syringe service programs. They work, they prevent disease, they save lives. And you know, it's not a debate, or it shouldn't be a debate over whether they're effective. That's been settled for many years. I think the proper legislative debate, and a debate I welcome, is over how they should work in Indiana. How should they be approved and designed? You know, what is the role of the state, and what is the role of local communities? Our legislation, by necessity in 2015, made it very difficult to start a syringe program. It authorized syringe programs statewide, but only with local initiative and approval. And that approval has been very difficult, and in many cases impossible to obtain. There's a struggle in many communities between public health and law enforcement when it comes to these this issue. That's something that I think we need to continue to look at.
Since lawmakers decided to allow syringe exchange programs in Indiana, 9 programs have been created across the state. What do they look like? Are they all basically the same thing?
No. I think if you've seen one program, then you've seen one program. Each program is unique. Each program is meeting the unique needs of its community. Of course, there are similarities, but each program was designed in response to community needs and using resources available in that community. And I think I talked about the challenge of local approval. The good news is that in the communities that have been able to start programs, there's a lot of local support and buy-in and collaboration, and the programs have led to a lot of good things. But it's just that initial hurdle of getting a program started. One thing I might mention is that even though there are only 9 counties with a syringe program, because of the population of several of those counties actually include about a third of the state's population. So the percentage of counties is misleading, even though it's only about 10% of Indiana's counties. Then if you consider neighboring counties where people may have access to a program in the county that has a program, even more people are being served.
Does Indiana need more exchange programs?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the challenge. You know, we have about a dozen counties that are doing harm reduction related to IV drug use. They have kits they're handing out that are aimed at harm reduction, trying to make things more sanitary and safer, you know, alcohol swabs and cotton balls and tourniquets and cookers and, you know, those sorts of things, which I know makes a lot of people uncomfortable. The only thing missing from those kits is syringes, which is unfortunate because that means many of those users are still having to reuse syringes or they're sharing syringes.
Have you heard from people who have used one of these programs?
Oh, yes. Yeah. There are some incredible stories. I hope you get a chance to interview some of those folks sometime. It's a reflection of the drug crisis. This touches everybody. And there are some amazing stories, including of recovery.
Have there been issues running these programs? Part of the challenge early on when the HIV epidemic hit Scott County in 2015 was that some of the areas being affected were rural and didn't necessarily have the resources or the specialists to address what was happening. Have those same issues had an effect on the execution of the syringe programs?
Well, again, you know, each program is operated locally, and resources are an issue. The 2015 legislation explicitly prohibited the use of state funds for purchasing syringes or needles, and Indiana ranks very poorly when it comes to public health funding. So many of these programs are operating on a shoestring, and they face the same challenges that all public health programs face in Indiana, lack of resources being the biggest.
What about health professionals? How have health professionals, you mentioned the state health commissioner, Dr. Box, but how have other health professionals a little closer to it reacted to these programs?
Most health professionals I've worked with simply view it as another appropriate tool, as an effective intervention that stops the spread of communicable disease and prevents a host of other health problems. You know, it's not just sharing needles, it's reusing needles, which can lead to infection, including sepsis, heart valve issues, and negative outcomes.
What we're seeing now, of course, what is going through and hopefully the governor signs is an extension for one more year. Do you plan on pushing for a permanent extension next session?
It's going to be an ongoing conversation, and I'll certainly be a part of it. I'm happy to work with anyone who wants to work on this. I'm looking forward to working with other legislators and with the State Health Department, with Dr. Box and the governor's office, you know, to continue to talk about the success of the existing programs and the potential for additional programs, the ways that these programs are making a tremendous difference. And, you know, I think it's important to note that the programs are first and foremost about harm reduction, about reducing the spread of communicable disease and reducing other harm. But, you know, we see very clearly that people who participate in syringe programs are more likely to connect with treatment and with other resources that can help them get to a better place. And that's something that's often lost in the conversation. I mean, the State Health Department has some very compelling numbers. They're seeing a lot of positive trends, and people are entering treatment and getting better. It's just, it's wonderful to see. Again, you know, in addition to preventing countless cases of disease, these programs have saved countless lives.
And finally, who are your allies on this? Who are perhaps co-authors? Who can you always count on there at the State House to back you up on this kind of an issue?
Well, I have a lot of great allies. Of course, I mentioned Governor Holcomb and Dr. Box. They've been wonderful since the beginning of the Holcomb administration, and certainly during this recent debate. But as far as other legislators, Representative Cook was on this bill, who has a fascinating history on HIV issues going back to Ryan White. He was Ryan White's principal and now serves in the legislature. But, you know, I'll say this. We picked up votes from several legislators who had previously opposed syringe programs, and I certainly don't want to speak for them, but I believe support is growing. And that was one of the best things about the vote yesterday, was seeing a handful of folks who had never voted for syringe exchange before make that yes vote for the first time. And certainly there's a lot of other content in the bill. You know, the underlying bill is about HIV modernization and suicide and overdose fatality review. And it was a very appropriate place to put the syringe language. And we also put some language in there to protect healthcare workers who receive an accidental needle stick. But there were several legislators whom I was expecting would have voted against it because of the syringe language, who instead voted for it, and I was very grateful for their support. So I'm optimistic that support is growing, and I think with additional advocacy and education, we can continue to see success with syringe service programs in Indiana. We can increase the number of programs, and we can increase the resources available to programs and the reach and quality of the programs, and just continue to do great things through these programs.
State Representative Ed Clear from District 72, which is just across the river from Louisville, west of I-65. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you. It's great being on your show.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast is wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Tomorrow, we will talk about the erosion of the lakeshore up north on Lake Michigan, why it's so serious, what needs to be done about it, and what's getting in the way. In the meantime, we are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.